10 years, and then there's a depression.
Well, yeah, like...
This is actually a very interesting thing. Governments never, by law, can print money, right?
Well, I mean, just, like, look at the stock market. 2 years ago, there was twice as much money as there is now. Except, well, we're printing it up to make the difference, but...
So since we're talking about conservation of energy, I'll get a little political here, but I won't take sides. I just think, so what is one of the major things that triggers this economic crash?
There was, people were leveraging bets that they didn't have the money to back up. They were pledging more money than they had.
What particular sector of the economy?
The banking finances.
So the banks basically, well, actually it started with things like, well, it was lenders in general that by law when I give you a mortgage, in reality as a bank, I only have to back up a certain percentage of that in cash, like let's say 10%. But then what they allowed all the investment firms to do is create these vehicles called derivatives, where they pooled all these investments that were already only backed by a fraction, and they built an investment vehicle out of that. Like, you could buy a share in this thing out called Joe, and Joe was actually a combination of 1,000 investments across the country. And then they leveraged that, so they leveraged leverage on top of leverage. So they kept building this pyramid, and at the bottom, and they were creating wealth. The scary thing is they're creating wealth,
mm-hmm.
but at the bottom, there's actually no the same amount of cash. Like when they started
buying stuff on margin.
Yeah,
that's essentially what it was.
I mean,
and then on top of it, people were insuring these things left and right.
So why is the government pumping money into all this? Very, really, very fundamental reason, I think.
Is pumping money into the government? Right?
What?
They're getting paid off to do it.
What? No. What happened with the depression? What was one of the claims that triggered the depression?
Well, it was
like banking system collapse.
And
again,
because banks
won't be tested on this material.
Banks made loans.
Lack of capital. Well, but what triggered that?
$1,000.
Right. So the run on the bank, right? People showed up to the bank and said, "I want my money out."
Right.
So why is the government now pumping money into the system?
Because
they want to basically prevent this.
They want people to.
If there's another run on the bank, and people actually start asking for their cash, they will find out. There's 100 times more commitments than there is cash to back raise up.
It's already happened. So you're going to get my money out of
the
you should have done that about.
It's been one of the arguments. And then you get so far into this that you can't really pull out of it. So a lot of people are saying, well, continue investing in 401ks and all these things.
Isn't that just like perpetuate the cycle? I mean,
well, it's a very, it's actually...
The problem is it's not zero-sum, so actually the valuation is completely wrong.
It's actually, okay, a lot of
people... It's not an actuality.
Hello! This actually plays into what we're going to talk about today. Because what we're going to talk about today are second-order systems, and this whole process of how you control a system is really, this is sort of a very simple model of what happens when you try to control systems. And the banking system is no different. You try to stimulate the system so that there's growth, but you don't want too much growth, so then you pull some of that investment back. And you try to control this, but you have a very loose control over it. You cannot control whether the system overcorrects or undercorrects sometimes. And we're going to discuss today how you actually design systems. It all really comes down to the way the impulse response of the system is as to how the system is going to behave. But the current banking crisis is actually a very good analogy that they're trying to pump some money into the system, but they don't want to pump too much money into the system. They want eventually for the system to settle and get back to its point of equilibrium, but they don't really, it's sort of uncharted waters how you actually do that. If you ever wondered about how interest rates are set, if you watch when Alan Greenspan and people, whatever his job was, I'm blanking on what his job was.
Chairman of the Fed.
How they set interest rates, it's the same deal. They look at inflation, they look at economic growth, and they try to control interest rates so that the system doesn't oscillate too much. They're able to sort of keep it operating in a normal level, but they don't want too much growth or too little growth because that triggers these kinds of crashes, if you will. So what happened in the past... So for many years, Alan Greenspan was considered like, you know, the greatest fifth chairman of the Fed. It's really hilarious. And now people are saying this whole thing is his fault because he was ignoring the mortgage market and all this stuff. But it's really interesting how when you start to control systems, that's a very dangerous thing because now the system becomes dependent on your control of it. And there's often an argument that you just let systems kind of run their natural course because intervening and trying to control them is often a much harder task. The government trying to control the economy, for example, tends not to work in some people's minds, some economists' minds, as well as just letting the economy run as a natural system. Because once you start controlling it, you're introducing kind of artificial inputs and constraints into the system. So we're going to talk about this in a very simple way with second-order systems today. The analogy I was going to use, do we have anybody who's a voter here? I was trying to think of...
A voter?
Yeah, who loves to vote.
Boats
on the water, right? So when you're trying... So boats are kind of interesting. Do anyone has ever driven the Mars land, the rover on Mars? That's actually more interesting. Have you ever wondered how a big boat hits a bridge?
Well,
the engineer, you have to ponder these great mysteries of life. How is it that a big barge runs into a bridge?
Wait, are we talking like hits the top of it or hits one of the piles?
It's the piles, you know, it's driving. You've got this barge. It's you know, carrying a cargo from Asia. It knows about this bridge. It's got to pass through days, months in advance, right?
Human error.
And yet, it somehow manages to hit this bridge, and oh my gosh, that was a surprise.
Well,
the bridge has been there for 100 years. The route has been decided for 100 years.
Was the captain drinking?
So what generally...
it only matters what you do in those last, you know, few minutes. You can know about the thing for a year. Like,
in maneuvering a ship of that size? There's an old phrase in the government that you can't turn a battleship on a dime.
Angle
of
the tugboat pushing around at like hours in advance.
These ships are so, there's so much inertia, and that you just don't turn them suddenly. So the course you're going to make decisions about that course far downstream, and if you make the wrong decisions at that point in time, you're going to hit that bridge because you can't turn this thing quickly. So boating is a good example of this because there's a lot of inertia in the system. If you've ever tried to steer a boat to a particular point, you don't actually go directly to that point, right? There's an arc. You kind of steer your way hoping that you'll eventually kind of drift into the system. That's exactly the kind of thing we're talking about today. To control and to understand second-order systems, you always have a trade-off between how rapidly they respond, how much overshoot you have, and how much oscillation you have. It's the trade-off between these parameters that really defines the system. And this lecture in particular, I think, is one of those lectures that really has a lot of, there's great analogies to real life in this, because most any system that you try to interact with, you have this problem that you can't control it completely. You apply a little bit of control, and hope then that the system behaves in the right way. And how you apply that control is what we're going to talk about today. And I've found many, many systems in life can be thought of in terms of these kinds of properties of second-order systems. So that's the good news. Now the bad news is, of course, you have to start with some mathematics. So,
yeah!
But math is bad. And we use the quadratic equation, so that's good math. So, recall our expression for a simple second-order differential equation, which is, we've got a differential equation on the left, we convert it to a Laplace transform and find the transfer function, and we have on the right this h of s is some constant over s squared plus a1s plus a0. Now, we're going to write this in terms of two parameters,
Zeta,
thank you. I always want to call it psi for some reason, but zeta and omega sub n. So this h of s, yeah, say zeta there. So we're going to write h of s in terms of omega sub n squared over s squared plus 2 zeta omega sub n s plus omega sub n squared. And the reason why we're going to do that will become clear once we do this analysis of the poles and zeros and such. So from the quadratic equation, we can write that the poles of this system are minus zeta times omega sub n plus or minus omega sub n times the square root of zeta squared minus 1. Now, why are we interested in the poles of this system?
Because that's the point at which it doesn't behave well at all.
Why? What do the poles represent?
The poles represent, like undefined terms.
So if you had to write a general expression for the impulse response for the system, what would you write? We could factor the denominator into its two poles, and we could separate with using partial fractions expansion, right? And we could write that h of s is going to be some constant So if we took the inverse Laplace transform of this, what would we get? If we took the inverse Laplace transform of this, what would we get? Well, we're going to get something like
e to the negative
log. So the impulse response is defined entirely in terms of the pole location. For example, if these poles turn out to be complex conjugates of each other, this will actually degenerate into a sine wave. It will oscillate. If these are real positive, the thing will be damped exponentials. And we'll go through those cases today. So we want to represent h of s in terms of its poles. And its poles are found from the quadratic equation using this equation. And there are three types of interesting behaviors for this system. The case where zeta is between 0 and 1, the case where zeta is equal to 1, and the case where zeta is greater than 1. And we'll look at those three cases today in more detail. But to sort of give you a heads up on that, here we have the impulse response of this system plotted as a function of zeta, from where zeta is from point 1 here, to 1.5, which is here. And here we have the step response the same way, from point 1 to 1.5. And you can see the behavior of the system changes dramatically depending on what the value of zeta is. So we want to study that in a little more detail so that the next time you're voting, you'll be able to hit your target. Or not hit your target, as the case may be. But if you've never had a chance to drive a really big boat, like a battleship or something, it's really interesting driving. Well, if you get like...
Have you ever driven a boat?
Okay.
Oh, okay.
But another good example of this is the Mars, the rover that they put on Mars. What's the biggest problem in driving a vehicle around Mars?
They tell it to do something and isolate it 7 minutes
later. 7 minutes, the time delay, right? So... You have to know that if you want to avoid running over into that crater, you better make that decision 7 minutes in advance. So what's the solution that they take?
They take small steps,
very slowly,
right?
And then try and make the robot have a lot more local smart, so that it doesn't do something catastrophic. You have the same kind of an issue that another contemporary example of this is flying these unmanned vehicles, the drones. You have a lot of those kinds of control issues with the drones as well. And with ships are interesting just because they have a lot of inertia. You don't turn ships almost any size boat. If you've ever driven one of those platform pontoon deals, right? I mean, they kind of maneuver like a car, but, not really. So when you want to go from point A to point B, if you drive straight, what happens? You find yourself downstream pretty quickly and that kind of thing. So with these big ships, especially these barges that carry like lots of cargo and things, those things they don't move much at all. I mean, they move very slow, and so you have to plot your course very carefully. I guess you could say the same is also true for airplanes when you're landing. When you're landing an airplane, you make a lot of decisions up front, and then you just kind of hope that you did the right thing, because once you get into that critical part of the descent, there's not much you can do other than pull up. You can't really make too many adjustments without either hitting the ground or pulling up, but you don't fly an airplane like you drive a car.
I learned a lot today.
Yeah, exactly. Great. You pay lots of money to learn some really profound things.
I think about that every time I'm flying and I land the plane. I'm like, man.
Yeah.
What if they made a mistake?
Blimps are interesting because they, in fact, I was reading an article about how you can actually become a blimp. What it takes to become a blimp pilot.
Kind
of an
interesting
one. What it takes?
Like, do you have what it takes? you can actually go somewhere and learn how to become a blimp pilot.
Wow.
Now, there's not too many job opportunities for that particular profession, but but they're similar because you have a lot of aerodynamics involved, and your ability—you have limited ability to maneuver the device.
Does that mean Zeppelin? Like,
you can actually buy a Zeppelin for about $15 million. I'll send the article to the class. It's kind of funny. Okay, so when zeta is greater than one. When zeta is greater than 1, both poles are real and distinct. That means we can write h of s as omega sub n squared over s minus p1 times s minus p2. The poles are real and distinct, which means if I take the inverse Laplace transform of that, I'm going to get basically e to the minus p1 t plus e to the minus p2 t, two damped exponentials. Now, what we want to do today is we want to look at the step response. So let's assume the input now is a unit step, u of t, which means when we take the Laplace transform of u of t, we get 1 over s. So we'll go ahead and multiply h of s times 1 over s, and we'll get y of s is equal to omega sub n squared divided by this times 1 over s. And then we can take the inverse Laplace transform of this. And again, if we separate this out with partial fractions, we'll have an e to the minus, or e to the p1t here, e to the p2t here, and then we'll have a constant term which is associated with the 1 over s of the unit step function. So this is the inverse Laplace transform of this. Now there's two components to this response. One is this dc term, which is due to the step input. And the other are these two exponential terms, which are due to the real and distinct poles. So in a moment, we'll plot that and we'll look at what that looks like graphically. But first, let's look at the case when zeta is equal to 1. In this case, both poles are real but repeated, so that we can write omega sub n squared, h of s is equal to omega sub n squared divided by s minus p1 squared. So again, we'll apply a unit step, x of s is equal to 1 over s. This should be y of s, as a product of these two. And when we take the inverse Laplace transform, we'll have a constant term associated with the 1 over s. But then we have the inverse transform of this s minus p1 squared. And we can find that in a number of ways. You've done a homework problem dealing with that. But that the inverse of this is going to be 1 plus omega sub n t e to the minus omega sub n t. This term roughly will correspond to that.
So s is your like complex frequency value, right? For
s is sigma plus g omega.
Right. So I mean that would be like your independent variable in the s plane, like your frequency.
Right.
Okay. So what are the values of zeta and omega in? if omega, I mean, is omega a frequency value as well, or?
Well, for now, just think of them as constants.
I mean,
that ultimately we could relate them, for example, to the R of L and C of that circuit.
Yeah.
But for now, just think of them as constants.
Okay.
In a moment, I'll show you what they mean. Obviously, zeta is obviously like a damping constant.
Yeah.
And omega sub n is something like a frequency.
Okay.
So, for the case where we have both real and repeated roots, if you plot the step response, you'll get this curve on the left. You'll see that it starts at zero, and it eventually converges to the input value, U of T. Okay, so let's think about that from a circuit point of view. If I apply a unit step function to this circuit, what happens at steady state?
Eventually, it just evens out.
It depends on LC, doesn't it?
Not steady state.
No, the steady state response is like the output is equal to the input.
Right. Exactly what happens. The capacitor charges, and the voltage here becomes the voltage here. So if I apply a unit step, we know the steady state value should be a DC value. And what happens in between is this kind of exponential growth depending on the values of RLC.
This is the worst part of the circuit. This is the worst part.
This was the worst part of circuit one?
Well, it was the part that made no sense because we hadn't had DE yet.
This is also the weak diagnosis in Europe, I think.
No, that was...
So if we have two real poles, the response is still very similar. It has this exponential rise. The shape of it is slightly different. It's a little bit hard to see with the resolution of the plot, but the shape is a little bit different. It's got that T, e to the alpha T shape, but the steady state behavior is essentially the same. So zeta is referred to the damping ratio because it controls the time constant of the impulse response. It controls the amount of time it takes for the response to reach steady state. Omega sub n is called the natural frequency, and it controls the frequency of oscillation, which we'll see in a moment for the case with two complex poles where the response actually does oscillate. Zeta greater than 1, the system is considered overdamped because it does not achieve oscillation and simply directly approaches its steady state value. I actually think that's backwards. I always thought they should call that underdamped, but for some reason historically that was considered overdamped because they seem to think oscillation is a good thing. So zeta equal to 1, the system is considered critically damped because it's on the verge of oscillation. So then we say, okay, what happens when zeta is between 0 and 1? When zeta is between 0 and 1, what happens to that square root term for the pole?
Well, it's
negative, right? So what do we get for the poles? We get an imaginary pole, right? But h of s has all real coefficients. So what does that mean about the two poles in the denominator? They have to be complex conjugate pairs. Otherwise, when you multiply them together, you would not get a polynomial with real coefficients. So for the case where zeta is between 0 and 1, we're going to define a term called omega sub d, which is equal to omega sub n times the square root of 1 minus zeta squared. And then we can write the poles in terms of an expression minus zeta times omega sub n plus or minus j times omega sub d. Now I'll explain that in a little more detail once we look at this graphically, but for the moment, just think of it as we've got these two constants, omega sub n and omega sub d. The transfer function can be rewritten in terms of the pole location, and what we can do is essentially rewrite this in terms of those quantities, and if you sort of work through the algebra, you can write this as omega sub n squared over s plus zeta omega sub n, that quantity squared plus omega sub d squared. The step response after some simplification can be written as 1 minus a constant term times e to the minus zeta omega sub n times t times sine of omega sub d times t plus c. And c is equal to omega sub d over zeta times omega sub n. That's just by taking the inverse Laplace transform of this. The details of that aren't as important as the general behavior. So we can notice a couple things. What happens when t goes to infinity? Assuming that these things are
zero.
Goes to zero, so the output reaches steady state value of 1.
Right.
However, in getting there, we have this sinusoidal response. So if you plot this thing, it looks like this. You have this oscillation. So the response can overshoot the steady state value and will oscillate around it, eventually settling into its final value. So this is really critical, and no pun intended, but these are often called critical frequencies. But think about this from a design point of view. By adjusting the values of this polynomial, you can control how quickly it takes for this thing to converge. Now, your first instinct is to say, oh, well, I'll just make it converge really quickly.
Depending.
But what happens when you try to make that thing converge really quickly?
It has frequency behavior.
It's going to oscillate. So then you say, oh, I'll make it converge really slowly. Then you get that slow convergence of the previous system, the overdamped system. So this is what I like to call a metaphor for life. You can get there quickly, but you're going to oscillate. And sometimes those oscillations can kill you. I used to like to talk about relationships. You can actually model human relationships with this kind of function. You've all been in situations where you've tried to get to the end goal, but unfortunately the system self-destructed before you reach that end state. And this is really, this is really true. And this is the same thing with operating that barge down the river. You can't, if you start doing a lot of little corrections, you're going to spend all your time correcting for the correction, because you'll make a little correction, then you'll try to correct that back, then you make that correction again. On the other hand, if you smooth out it and take it very gradually, like the responses we saw on the other page, then you better get it right, because by the time you get close to that bridge, you've already made the decision. So you're not able to make those really instantaneous corrections. You use the same kind of a design when you're designing something like a motion control. Motion control circuits are really cool. Lights activated by motion. Because, if you think about that problem, if you simply turn the light on or off any time any object is detected, the light's going to be turning on and off quite a lot. Right? And they usually give you an adjustment for this, but you figure out pretty quickly that you want to adjust the light so that when it turns on, it stays on for a while, and then it eventually goes off when, after a certain amount of time, no motion is detected. And then they'll start up over again. Well, guess what? This is exactly the kind of circuit they use. They use a second-order circuit to implement that kind of a timer. And then you can also, with those kinds of systems, you have to control how quickly you decide to let it exceed through the threshold before it turns on and things like that. So this design of the system to balance this oscillation or overshoot with time to convergence, this is a really fundamental property of systems. Now, the neat thing is, we've been talking a lot about differential equations. If the system is modeled by a second-order differential equation, you only have these three types of responses to choose from. If you want some kind of different response, more a different kind of shape, you're probably going to have to go to a higher-order system. And that's why filter design is another one of these fundamental challenges, because with filter design, you basically decide what's the number of components that I need to meet my specification. So if you aren't happy with any of these three behaviors, these are the only three behaviors you can get out of a second order system. You can't invent new behaviors. If this were a first order system, what's the only behavior you can get out of it?
Exponential.
So if you're not happy with first order or second order, you have to go up to a higher order. And that's essentially what you worry about when you design filters. You take specifications like impulse response, a frequency response, and then you try to design the filter with the lowest order to meet those specifications. But there's no right or wrong. Ultimately, your customer or your application has to really tell you what the right convert time to convergence is, what the right overshoot, what the maximum amount of overshoot is that you'll allow. Another example of this, why do you want to control overshoot? Well, again, think about another example we talked about throughout the semester. You're sitting on the bridge and the truck rolls by. And the bridge starts vibrating. Now, you're sitting next to the civil engineer who designed the bridge, and he says, no problem, it will settle out. It will reach steady state. But that shouldn't completely comfort you. Why?
Did you go to Ole Miss?
Yeah, you go to Ole Miss, I tell you where you're going. You're going down into the water. Now, why is overshoot? Why should you be worried about the overshoot?
Because of the next truck. Physical systems have limitations on their overshoot.
In the process of going through that overshoot, you may exceed momentarily the design capabilities of the structure, and the structure will fail. So they actually have to design the structure with bridge-type structures. They have to design them to damp this kind of overshoot. Otherwise, the structures are, you know, they'll oscillate beyond their tolerance and they'll crash or class. I was actually watching something on CNN this morning. I don't know what prompted it, but now they're talking about what's going to happen if an earthquake. There's a prediction that a 9 on the Richter scale earthquake is going to hit the Pacific Northwest at some point. There's a fault line running right along the coast where Seattle is, and they're talking about tens of millions of people are going to be killed when this thing hits. And we've talked a little bit about whether they can accurately predict this or not, but what was interesting, which relates to this lecture, is they were talking about how an earthquake of scale 5 and 9 are different. With an earthquake of scale 9, you actually go through a protracted amount of kind of long-term vibration. It lasts for, they said, minutes, like 10, 15 minutes. And that kind of vibration is going to cause many structures to collapse because they haven't been designed for such a sustained type of vibration. It's the same kind of thing that you have to, with building structures and things, worry about the overshoots and the undershoots, especially when you have events like trucks rolling across the bridge. So a lot of structures are often designed to carry a lot of weight, but that's not actually what makes them fail. What often will make them fail is an impulsive response. A rapid change in the weight that will cause them to go into this vibration and this overshoot and undershoot type thing. And resonating with the wind, like we've talked about, is one of the ways that will happen.
Could vehicles traveling over the bridge above the prescribed speed, like a large truck going?
Yeah, because that's essentially determining the amount of impact. It's like an impulse response. And whether you have a lot of weight and you're going slow, or a little weight and you're going fast, you know, there's sort of the same amount of energy.
Yeah.
And I think, now some of you in here worked on the robotics competitions, right? So you face these kinds of design issues when you're trying to have, make the robots correct and navigate and things like that. And it's always fun to see the students kind of discover these things and, you know, as they're putting the robots together.
Space palm.
What?
Space palm.
Well, they all usually, you know, typically when you're building things like that, you'll design it without all the controls that you realize you need. So, you know, it's always fun the first few runs when it, like, runs into a wall. Works fine, but then, like, it runs into a wall or something. So then you start worrying, then you start realizing, okay, we need more controls and that kind of thing. So zeta greater than 1 is what we call overdamped because the system really just, we have zeta 1 is the second curve. The system just sort of rises and then settles out smoothly. So here we have zeta is equal to 1 for the step response. I mean zeta greater than 1. Zeta equal to 1 is critically damped. I'm sorry, so this is zeta equals 1. This is sort of on the brink of oscillation. If zeta becomes smaller, the system oscillates. If zeta becomes larger, the system just kind of smoothly goes to your to steady state. But you'll notice that the time it takes to reach this steady state value is longer here and shorter here. But the price you pay here is that you oscillate, whereas here you get this nice smooth convergence. And that, so that becomes a design issue, essentially. How fast you want the system to respond to changes versus how smoothly you want it to reach its steady state value.
It actually, but I mean, if you're looking for a steady state value, like if this is like a rectifier or something, you only hit the steady state value for an infinitesimally small amount of time before you're swinging back down again.
Right, right, right. So the oscillation is not necessarily a good thing, but if you're dealing with a time-varying system like audio, you probably don't want to wait this long to get convergence. You have to live with a little bit of oscillation because the signal is constantly changing and you want to adapt to that. Now, so let's now talk a little bit, about this omega sub n and omega sub d. So the pole locations are located at minus zeta omega sub n plus or minus j times omega sub d. So we can actually write that in terms of some vector, you can think of it as a vector or in the complex plane. Here we have a, this point represents omega sub n. Omega sub d is the distance of this point from the vertical axis, from the imaginary axis, and zeta omega sub n is the distance along the real axis. So what do we say about zeta omega sub n in terms of its influence on the overall impulse response?
Strictly responsible for oscillation.
Not oscillation.
If the pole
were located here, what would be the impulse response?
Exponential.
Right, e to the alpha t, or e to the minus alpha t is alpha positive.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we say that this is stable, right? If the pole were located over here,
it would be unstable.
So this determines stability, and it determines the amount of damping. Because that's going to relate to the c to the alpha t. Now, what about omega sub d?
And that determines the like sinusoidal, like the magnitude of that component on top of the exponential one.
Not so much the magnitude, but what about that sinusoidal?
And the frequency.
And so, what controls the frequency of oscillation here is omega sub d, the distance of this pole from the real axis. The bandwidth of the pole is proportional to the distance from the J omega axis. That's another way of describing this. So in the case where we have complex conjugate poles, the closer these are to the imaginary axis, the sharper the frequency response is going to be. The further these are from the J omega axis, the broader the frequency response is going to be. So these this represents the sharpness of the bandwidth of the pole. No?
I can understand, like, the fact that it does that, I guess. But I only see it on certain side.
So let's look at that one some more, Java Atlas.
Yeah.
So this is in a complex plane where I have the cursor, and if I visualize this in 3D space, what's it going to look like? So this is a second order polynomial with two complex with the complex conjugate poles.
Yeah, two peaks.
Right. So this is going to look like sort of a two peak mountain range.
Right.
You're going to have these two peaks. And when you walk along the J omega axis, that's how you get the frequency response, right? You're going to essentially walk up the side of the mountain, right? So you're going to get a frequency response, which looks like this. And this, the sharpness of this depends essentially on the sharpness of this mountain and the distance that you can start from one another. So we can look at this in so it's something like that. So as you walk along the imaginary axis, you're going to see some rise and then some fall due to the fact that you've got these peaks and you're essentially walking up the side of these peaks. And depending on where we move these poles, so if we now move these poles closer to the J omega axis, what should happen to the peaks? Smaller? No, not smaller.
Shorter. If we move closer to which axis? The imaginary,
they should get sharper, right? Because the bandwidth, the pole is closer to the J omega axis. So if I put them out, let's make sure we're in. Actually, we were in the digital mode. Okay, so the poles now are pretty far away from the, relatively speaking, are far away from the J omega axis. So the frequency response reflects that. Now what happens when we move these closer to the J omega axis? The bandwidth of the pole should become sharper. So the distance from the J omega axis determines the bandwidth of the pole. What about the height along the J omega axis? What does that determine?
Height.
Right, but in terms of characterizing, the pole is characterized by its frequency and its bandwidth. So as you move the pole up along the J omega axis, if we move the poles up here, what's going to happen to the frequency of the pole? You can see on the display here what's happening. Frequency decreases as you move towards the real axis, and the frequency increases as you move away from the real axis. So as you move, so here's the imaginary axis. As you move the frequency along, as you move the pole along the imaginary axis, this thing is going to slide in this direction, which is going to change essentially the frequency location of the pole. So so the response of this system, of this second order system, is completely characterized by this damping ratio zeta and this omega sub d. And therefore you can design these systems in terms of either properties of the step response, like the time to convergence and such, or you can design them in terms of frequency and bandwidth of the poles. There are several different ways you can choose those parameters, but ultimately it's a second order system and there's only essentially 2 degrees of freedom, the frequency and bandwidth of these two complex constant poles. So here's an example of a C circuit, which is a first order system, and we're going to apply a sine wave to this system. So we have the input is cosine omega 0 t. The transfer function h of s, we've previously worked this, as, can be written as k over s minus t. So we can compute y of s as the product of x of s times h of s, and then we can take the inverse Laplace transform, and we can get something that looks like this, which again now has a couple components to it. The solution is a superposition of a transient response, this e to the pt term, and then the steady state response, which is due to the input, the input sine wave. The steady state response could have been found by simply evaluating the Fourier transform at omega 0, its frequency, and applying the magnitude scaling and phase shift to the input signal, y. If you apply a sine wave to that circuit and you want to get the steady state value of the output, all you really need to do is to evaluate the Fourier transform at the frequency of the sine wave, y. Well, we know that that's a linear system, and therefore if you put a sine wave in, you get a sine wave out, and the only thing that's going to be different is the amplitude and phase. So the last thing I wanted to comment on today is, you know, I really enjoyed reading all these excellent solutions on the reworked exam problem. And I think if you understand the material at that level, there shouldn't be any problem in this course. So what we need to think about over the next few weeks is how we can bridge the gap between what you understood at the time you took that exam and what you demonstrated when you actually had some time to work that problem and understand it. I think with the solution, people understand quite a lot, and I think now you know how to use MATLAB to verify things and as a tool. So I was very pleased with the level of understanding and the reworks. The only thing now we need to do is somehow close the gap between what happens on the exam
and what you're capable of if you have more time and you can work as a group and you can pass around solutions and all that good stuff. Get it?
I think the key difference is having a week of looking.
Yeah. So if I gave you the 1 hour exam I give you, I should give you like 3 weeks.
That's really not a bad idea.
So what did I say at the beginning of the semester about time to solution?
It's irrelevant in industry. It's no bearing on anything at all.
All right, so I'll see you on Wednesday.
Time to market is not a factor.